This is The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega, and I'm thrilled to be back with you in the host chair today. We start with a look at the latest on the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. U.S. health agencies have called for a pause on the distribution of the single-shot Johnson & Johnson vaccine as they investigate its potential link to an extremely rare blood clotting disorder. The decision comes after 6 reported cases of women developed blood clots after receiving the J&J vaccine. One of those women has died. The CDC and the FDA recommended the pause on the J&J vaccine, quote, out of an abundance of caution. And we should be clear that nearly 7 million people have received the J&J vaccine in the U.S. so far, with the overwhelming majority reporting zero or mild side effects. And so far, there are no concerns about blood clots with either the Moderna or Pfizer vaccines. Here to answer our questions and yours is Dr. Megan Ranney, an emergency physician and director of the Brown Lifespan Center for Digital Health. Dr. Ranney, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Tanzina. It's a joy to join you.
So let's start with the details. There were 6 cases of clotting. What do we know about are these directly related to the J&J vaccine?
We don't know for sure yet. I think the thing that gives us suspicion that they're related is that the type of clot that we're seeing, that's a combination of clotting in the veins or arteries and low platelets, is first of all very unusual. And second of all is the same type of clotting that was observed with the AstraZeneca vaccine, which is made in a similar way to the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. So out of an abundance of caution, the CDC and FDA are asking for a pause until we figure out a little bit more.
I want to ask you a little bit more about the comparison to the AstraZeneca vaccine in just a minute. But what struck me, Dr. Ranney, is that the cases that we're talking about were all women. What more do we know about these women? Are they in the same age group? Were there, do we know anything else about the women particularly that were affected here?
So we know that all the women in the United States that had these clots were of childbearing age. And we know women in that age group are a little higher risk for blood clots in general, sometimes because we get pregnant, sometimes because we're on oral contraceptives, sometimes for reasons that we don't really know. Beyond that, we're waiting on data. I know that the Council on Immunization Practices is going to be reviewing more extensive data this afternoon. And so I think by mid-afternoon, we're going to know a lot more about the characteristics of these women, if they had any similar factors that may have predisposed them to having this unusual type of clotting disorder.
Dr. Ranney, do we know anything else about, we mentioned the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines so far have not had any issues when it comes to blood clotting, but I'm wondering if women in particular who've taken either of those vaccines also experience similar types of side effects.
A great question. A really important point is that the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines are made with a totally different technology from the Johnson & Johnson or AstraZeneca vaccines. Pfizer and Moderna are made with mRNA. Johnson & Johnson and AstraZeneca are made with an adenovirus or cold virus vector. It's basically the shell of a cold virus that's used to introduce this little teeny bit of the COVID spike protein into your body so that you can create an immune reaction. Because of that, we don't suspect that there's going to be any overlap, and there really haven't been any reports of blood clotting disorders among folks receiving those mRNA vaccines. So I think of them as being a totally separate category of vaccine, despite the fact, of course, that they're both vaccinating for the same disease.
Dr. Ranney, I'm wondering, and again, I'm not sure, you know, how much we know about this because this is such a process that's been so fast in terms of creating these vaccines. But as we know, the medical establishment tends to test women less frequently than they do men. And I'm not sure if that also happened with the development of these vaccines for coronavirus. Were women part of trials in the way that perhaps men may have dominated the trial process?
They actually did a pretty good job of matching on gender in these trials. But remember, this unusual side effect is only being seen in about 1 in a million cases. Even if their trials had been entirely women, it's really unlikely that they would have picked this up because the trials were, 20,000, 30,000, 40,000 people. they're not going to see this one in a million case. And if even if they saw one case, it wouldn't have been enough to make them concerned that it was linked to the vaccine.
What kind of calculus was behind the decision, in your expert opinion, that the CDC and the FDA took to pause the distribution of the J&J vaccine?
So obviously, I'm not part of the CDC or the FDA, but you know, knowing what I know about public health, I think they most likely paused J&J vaccine distribution for a couple of reasons. The first is there was evidence from Europe that the vaccine there is the AstraZeneca vaccine is linked biologically to this unusual type of clot. So they have a reason to then think that J&J is linked to this unusual type of clot being seen in the U.S. The second is that they need to let doctors and other healthcare practitioners know that this happens because it is so unusual, because you do treat it differently from regular blood clots. It's important to get that information out. And then the third thing is that they want to get a little more information. They want to stimulate some reporting, and they wanted a little bit of time to assess risks of the vaccine versus benefits. The FDA's primary job to the American people is safety and protecting us. And so from their perspective, they don't want to hide anything. They'd rather err on the side of caution.
I was just going to say, transparency feels like it's a really big part of this. And we're going to be talking more about the messaging around these vaccines and the virus later in the show today. But in terms of just, you know, regulatory steps that are taken with any vaccine or medication, this is pretty typical, isn't it?
Yeah, it is utterly typical to monitor new medications, new medical devices after they go on the market. There's a whole system for that, and medicines and devices actually have to submit reports and guarantee that they're going to do post-approval marketing. So it's not uncommon to find problems after something is released. They're usually really, really rare problems like this one, and they rarely ultimately change the FDA's decisions about whether or not to keep a drug on the market. So this is not an unusual thing. The difference is, of course, the vaccines are so caught up right now in both in politics and in this horrible moment that we're in, where we all have been hoping that the vaccines are going to be the way out of this past year and a half, which is, I think, part of the reason that we're all paying so much attention to this news.
Now, we should be clear that pausing is not the same thing as stopping the distribution of the vaccine, and that this pause is a recommendation, not a mandate. Am I right there?
That is exactly right. It is a temporary pause until the FDA and CDC can do a little more information gathering. And again, until their Council on Immunization Practices can, which is an independent body of scientists, until they can meet and look at the data. It in no way, shape, or form is the same as withdrawing authorization. And in fact, very few of us in the public health world expect to see authorization withdrawn. What we may see is recommendations to limit the use of the J&J vaccine to folks who are lower risk for, again, this very, very rare complication.
This recommendation comes at, as we were talking about this yesterday with my team, I thought the worst timing for something like this is right now. As you mentioned earlier, we're trying to get past this. We're trying to get vaccines in arms and distributed. How long, doctor, do we expect this pause to be in effect? And I know that's a hard question to assess, and it's okay if we don't have a timeline. But I'm just curious, because I think the timing of this could hurt folks' perception of the vaccines.
I don't have an answer for how long the pause will be in effect. It may go away as early as this afternoon, or it may last for another week or two. But I worry that the damage on people's perceptions may already be done. We saw a dramatic decrease in the number of Europeans who were willing to be vaccinated after a similar pause on the AstraZeneca vaccine. And I'm quite worried about that here in the U.S., which is one of the reasons that I try to keep emphasizing first that the Moderna and Pfizer vaccines have not changed in their risk assessment. And second, for the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, even if these side effects, these unusual rare blood clots, do end up being linked to the J&J vaccine, they are still so much less common than the risk of catching COVID or being hospitalized from COVID, or the risk of any of a thousand other everyday things that we all decide to take on the risk of. So it may not ultimately change our risk calculus. It just is a thing to be aware of, just like we're aware of side effects from aspirin or oral contraceptives or blood pressure pills or anything else that we do on a take into our body on a daily basis.
And it's interesting you mentioned the side effect, brief list of side effects, because so many of us who, I guess I'm among the rare that still watch network television, but the ads that come on about medications list side effects so quickly you can barely process them these days. So I'm wondering, you know, we've had people who have reached out to us and are worried about what they should do if they receive the vaccine, if a loved one received the vaccine. There's someone who reached out to us who said they had heart issues, someone who's already predisposed to blood clotting. What do they do? Should they be okay or should they be monitoring themselves for any changes?
So the first thing is, again, it's a one in a million chance. So you could go win the lottery, hopefully, before you're going to get this unusual, but very horrible, rare side effect. So take a deep breath. Chance of this happening to you is quite small. Your point, Tanzina, about the side effects for so many of those medicines whose ads we see on TV, those side effects are so much more common. As an ER doc, I can tell you, I frequently see people with side effects from other medications that occur at a much higher rate than this one. That said, if you have gotten the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, know that this problem has shown up in general somewhere between 1 and 2 weeks after you get the vaccine. So it doesn't happen the same day. And if you're a month out, it's unlikely to show up then. And the things to watch out for are a severe headache, something different from what you normally get, changes in your vision or your ability to move your arms or legs or to feel your arms and legs. So stroke-like symptoms, or severe trouble breathing, or severe belly pain, basically anything that would make you consider calling the doctor or going to the ER anyhow, would be something for you to go to the ER or call your doctor and let them know that you got the J&J vaccine a couple of weeks ago.
And as a provider yourself, are you expecting to address these concerns in patients?
I am. I'm already hearing from my colleagues across the country that we're seeing increasing number of folks come into our ERs and doctor's offices concerned.
Dr. Ranney, I want to pivot for a minute here, because we've talked a lot about the vaccine hesitancy narrative, which is something we'll get into more in a minute. But what about vaccinating children? I know Pfizer said that they are going to start vaccines, at least trials on younger people, 12 and up. There's vaccines have been now been available in certain cities across the country for those 16 and older. Where do we stand with those under 18?
So Pfizer is already approved for age 16 and up. And they now have data showing that their vaccine is 100% effective in age 12 to 15. And I expect that we'll be seeing FDA emergency use authorization for that age group within a month or two. I am so excited about that. I'll say I'm a mom of two kids. One of them fits in that 12 to 15 age group. And I can't wait to get that child vaccinated. It is just going to transform her ability to be able to be with friends without a mask on, and is going to make her so much safer at school. I expect that the younger age groups, my other kid probably won't be eligible for a vaccine until the winter or so, unless I manage to get him into a trial. So for parents across the country, I would say to expect that your 12 and up should get vaccinated hopefully this summer, and the younger kids midwinter to the beginning of next year.
So we can expect younger children to potentially be on the list for vaccines.
I would expect so. They've already started doing trials. There's no reason to think that these vaccines won't work in the younger age groups. And I think it's important to get them vaccinated, although the younger kids are not at high risk of the severe side effects of COVID. They certainly can catch it. And just like with the side effects of the J&J vaccine, when kids do get sick, there's the potential for them to get quite sick. And as a parent, if you can avoid that, it's always a good thing to protect your kid.
There is lots of talk about opening schools in the fall and vaccines becoming a part of that conversation. We know, particularly when it comes to colleges, college students, some colleges are mandating students get vaccines. That feels like a very traditional thing to do. I mean, when you go to school, you have to sort of provide your measles and mumps and other types of vaccine proof. Without getting into a debate about vaccine passports, this feels very standard, I would imagine, for places like universities.
That's exactly right. My own university, Brown, is going to be requiring vaccinations for students coming back in the fall semester. And it's exactly what we do around other typical vaccines like meningitis or measles, mumps, and rubella. It's a way to protect the community. And I hate to see it politicized because it's something we've been doing for quite a long time. This is standard practice for schools and even for businesses and hospitals across the country.
Let's talk a little bit. We're going to be talking about this later in the program, but I'm curious about the messaging about vaccines. And you know, going back to the beginning of the pandemic, the messaging that we've gotten from everyone from public health officials on down has been confusing. You know, I remember a year ago we were being told don't wear masks, and then it was wear masks. And so, you know, there's a lot of confusion, I think, about the messaging around this. But I'm wondering from your perspective, whether you think, particularly around vaccines and vaccine hesitancy, there's been the narrative of hesitancy overplayed in communities of color and perhaps underplayed among, say, Republicans, 40% of whom have so far in a poll that we mentioned earlier said that they're not interested in getting the vaccine.
Absolutely. And I actually prefer to use the term vaccine confidence, because I think based on the studies that I and others have done, what we actually see is that folks just don't really understand or don't yet trust the vaccine. They worry it was developed so quickly or it hasn't been followed for long enough. Now, both the mRNA and the adenovirus vectors are new technologies for vaccines in humans, but not actually all that new. They've both been in development for decades. This is just the first time there's been enough federal funds to get them over the finish line into something that's been fully approved. And so I think there's a lack of information. And as you say, the confusion of the messaging can hurt that confidence. And this latest pause is only going to make that tougher. But I think the big takeaway, first of all, we need to teach public communication in public health schools. And secondly, we need to work with communities to recognize that the same message doesn't necessarily resonate for everyone, whether it's communities of color or rural communities. They need folks that make sense and speak in the language that makes sense to them.
And of course, you know, we ourselves here in the media, quote unquote, can't leave ourselves off the hook. How would you assess how the media has taken the information from public health officials and others and communicated it to the general public? I mean, that's what we're supposed to do, right?
It is, but I think it's tough because the information is changing so quickly and the media wants a story. It's tough to communicate nuance sometimes, particularly in short TV segments or social media.
Is there something that you suggest the media or public health officials can do better at communicating this so we don't have, I mean, so we can kind of reach that line between, you know, getting the headline or getting the story and not frightening the population, but also being transparent? It's a really tricky balance.
It is a tricky balance. And I think part of it is having medical or public health folks on staff to help translate the latest news, to make sense of it, to provide storylines that are nuanced and accurate, and also to not overpresent or overpromise. Very little in a pandemic is a clear yes or clear no. There are these shades of gray in between. And we've seen it with the 15-minute rule, with the 6 feet versus 3 feet, with droplets versus aerosols. The science is evolving, and it's a place where we need to be able to, it's a challenge, right, to explain those small gradations that can make a difference. And so to me, for the media, it would be having those of us with public health backgrounds to help inform you. So I appreciate the chance to be on today with you.
That's why we talk to you. Dr. Megan Ranney is an emergency physician and director of the Brown Lifespan Center for Digital Health. Dr. Ranney, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
When it comes to fighting vaccine hesitancy, the word of community leaders goes a long way in reaching places where skepticism and distrust persist, particularly in areas where vaccines are readily available, but residents are reluctant to sign up. In the rural Mississippi Delta region, Pam Chapman, founder of Boss Lady Workforce Transportation, has been doing just that, whether that means driving Mississippi residents to vaccine sites or advocating to bring the vaccine sites to them. Pam, welcome to the show.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
So tell us what your work looks like. You've been doing this work in Mississippi since the pandemic began. What do you do exactly?
We created what is called the VTI, which is Vaccination Transportation Initiative. We wanted to make sure that people in the rural areas of Mississippi did not have an excuse that they didn't have transportation or they didn't have the funds to pay for transportation. So we actually created that so that we can help transport people to the different clinics that's around Mississippi Delta area to get them to get vaccinated at no cost.
And so, Pam, we know that Mississippi has one of the lowest rates of vaccine distribution so far. You know, in a prior segment, we were talking about the fact that there was a website meant to sign people up that had thousands of unfilled vaccine appointments. How do you, when you see something like that, how does that square with the work that you do?
Well, you know, I think one of the reasons why we're still having that large number of registration is because all of a sudden people like myself have started to have park book vaccination in different communities. So people do not have to register to get that vaccination. They just come up and show their ID. So we're starting to see long lines here across Mississippi at pop up. Because we're popping up actually in their own environment, in their own community, and people here feel safer just going to their own community sites.
So the pop-up sites are working that in terms of what you're seeing, they're working because they're just like, here, you can get a vaccine today. You don't need to have a special appointment. You can just show right up.
Absolutely. And then also that helps because a lot of people here still do not have internet access. And so they just pop up at the drive-through vaccinations and just show their ID and be done with it. And so they don't have to go through the time of you can come next month, you can come next week. You get the shot, you get the vaccination right then and there. So when you make up your mind that this is what you want, go through the drive-through and get it over with.
Pam, is that the biggest barrier to getting people in the Mississippi Delta region vaccinated? Is it not having internet access? What is it in your opinion?
You know, the accessibility is always a key for Mississippi because we do not have a lot of public transit that rolls every day consistently. That is one barrier. The other barrier is that we do not have internet access in a lot of different rural communities. And then the other big thing is that people just don't believe that this vaccine is what they need to take.
Pam, who are we talking about in Mississippi? Who are you seeing are some of the folks that are most hesitant to be vaccinated? Because there's so many different stories and narratives that emerge, whether it's people of color, Latinos, Black people, Republicans. Who are you seeing in your community that's having the most trouble getting vaccinated?
We're seeing a lot of hesitance from the younger generation. I've been doing the drive-through transportation vaccinations. And when I go, I'm not seeing not one young person at the age of 18 show up. We're seeing a lot of the elderly community people come out to the vaccination. So the younger generation, it is hard.
And when you say, is there a difference in terms of the race of folks that you're looking at as well? Or is we know that there have been, I think some of these narratives have been done over and over where it seems to focus just on Black and brown communities. But there's evidence that white Americans also have vaccine hesitancy.
Absolutely. I'm not seeing a whole lot of them at the current ones that I've been attending here across Mississippi. But yesterday I was at one and we had a very diverse group of people there. We had Chinese, we had Caucasians, and so we also have African Americans. So yesterday we did see a diverse group of people come out to get vaccinated.
Some of the pop-up vaccination sites have been at interesting locations. One of them was recently at the B.B. King Museum, right?
Absolutely. I was there. Yes, ma'am. Mm-hmm. It was a very great turnout because it was very interesting. Let me say that because we noticed that a lot of the people that came to get vaccinated at the B.B. King Museum, they all were in the J&J line. There was absolutely no one in the Moderna line. It was very amazing to see so many people stay in line for hours of 3 and 4 blocks long just to get the J&J.
Now, we know that J&J has been paused this week because of concerns over blood clots. What is that? Are you concerned about that pause?
Very much so. We had scheduled a drive-through pop-up yesterday where we had about 300 plus to register for the J&J. No one else wanted anything else but the J&J. And as soon as 5 o'clock that morning hit about the J&J being stopped, we immediately went down to 50 people. That's a big concern for us here in Mississippi, because a lot of the people just want to do the one shot and be done with it. So if we can get anything that encouraged them to get vaccinated, and when the J&J pulls out, we can see it, the numbers. We see the reactions from them being pulled.
Now, of course, this isn't so far, this isn't a permanent change, but it is a change that's happening right now as health officials try to determine what's happening. Why is there such a preference for the J&J shot? Is it also because the vaccine itself is easier to administer? It doesn't require all the sort of special temperature, cold spaces that all of these other shots require. But is it also just a question of ease? And do you think that taking away the J&J shot is going to at least temporarily, maybe not stop the flow, but do you think people are going to get worried and maybe not want to come out at all?
We do have that concern. But a good example is last night we received an email from a lady who asked us, you know, when is J&J coming back? I only want to take that. I have a pacemaker. So can you please keep me updated on when you will have the J&J? So different people have different health concerns and they feel more comfortable is I don't have to come back. I just want to get it done and get it over with. So we're hearing a lot of that. And so that's what people are saying when they pulled out yesterday. We just don't want to do it.
Pam, what kind of help do you need or are you getting from Mississippi health officials and or government officials there?
I'm proud to say that I have had a lot of help. We've had help from our hospitals. We've had help from a community foundation of Northwest Mississippi. We've had help from all the different clinics. People have all been all hands on deck trying to do what we can to encourage these individuals here to get vaccinated. So I'm just grateful that we've had great support from the community health individuals and organizations here in Mississippi.
Pam Chapman is the founder of Boss Lady Workforce Transportation. Pam, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
When the $1.9 trillion American Rescue Plan was signed into law last month, one of the most notable pieces of funding included in the bill was the roughly $32 billion allocated to tribal governments and other services that support Native populations. As a result of centuries of neglect by the United States government, Native Americans have faced disproportionately high death rates from COVID-19, and the pandemic has also taken a heavy financial toll on Native communities. Now, tribal leaders and advocates see the latest stimulus funding as a chance to finally make some progress when it comes to more robust federal support for Indian Country. But there are also reasons to be skeptical about whether the Biden administration can efficiently distribute these funds. After the CARES Act was signed into law by former President Trump last March, many tribes waited months to receive the full aid included in that package. Eric Henson is a research affiliate with the Harvard Project on American Indian Economic Development and a citizen of the Chickasaw Nation. Eric, welcome back to the show.
Thank you. So glad to be here.
So we mentioned right there that the constraints that were put on the funds allocated to tribes in this latest, I'm wondering how these constraints put on funds allocated to tribes in this latest stimulus package compared to the ones that were put in place in the CARES Act under Donald Trump.
Yes, thank you. That's a good question. Our read of the ARPA, we call it, the American Rescue Package Plan Act, is that there are less restrictions on tribes. Therefore, explicitly enunciated ways that the funds are supposed to be used, responding to the pandemic and its negative economic impacts, providing premium pay to essential workers, replacing COVID-related lost revenues, and making necessary investments in water, sewer, and broadband infrastructure. So our read is that's a fairly broad list of acceptable uses, and so tribes should feel a little bit less concerned about some of the worries they had last year about allowed uses of the funding.
There are more than 570 tribes, each that has its own specific needs. What are some of the ways that you expect to see these different tribal governments use the federal aid?
Sure. One thing that the ARPA has done that was lacking in the CARES Act is ARPA gives the tribes a much longer period over which to use the money. So last year in the CARES Act, as you mentioned, it was passed early in the year and had an explicit mandate that the money be spent by the end of the calendar year. So for many tribes, it was a relatively large amount of money, and there was a very short deadline. So there was very little ability to plan and engage in projects that might take a long time. You know, this one of the four uses that are explicitly outlined here involves infrastructure. And obviously, lots of infrastructure investment takes a long time to plan and have contracted and have it built out. So we think that tribes are likely to have a better chance of investing in these kind of building blocks that will support their tribal economies going forward, as opposed to feeling this pressure of immediately responding right away. Oh my goodness, we just have to spend the money by the end of this year. So just spend it on whatever comes to mind. We think that's going to be quite helpful as tribes look at what they need to do to bring their tribal enterprises back online, to deal with the negative health impacts they've been experiencing, and things of that nature.
You and your colleagues released a policy brief last week about this funding and how it should be allocated. What other recommendations do you have related to how this aid is dispersed?
Sure. We feel like it's important that the Treasury should proactively set up some advisory panel, some sorts of technical expertise, should engage in a process of advising tribes with what we call advisory letters. We were thinking of the model that the IRS currently uses. If you are a taxpayer and you've got a particular question, you can ask the IRS for an opinion letter about, if I do my taxes in the following way, do you think it will be okay if you audit me down the road? And we see something like that as a very useful way of responding to tribes. We've got like a 3-year window here for some of this money to be used and committed to different uses. And so there's some time for tribes to come up with good plans, think about how they want to best use the money, and then go to Treasury and say, hey, we want to just make sure this is a usable, workable plan and that you agree that it falls under the allowed uses of the funding before we go spend the money. And we don't want to have to dicker with you down the road about whether we are supposed to pay you back because you don't think it was an allowed use. So that's one of our big recommendations that Treasury should consider.
How do you ensure that the U.S. government can continue to fund tribes, not just in times of crisis, but make this a permanent part of the federal budget?
Well, it's really a matter of priority. You know, U.S. Commission on Civil Rights put out two major reports, one in 2003 and another one in 2018, that document the persistent and ongoing lack of adequate funding for tribal needs, even compared to just non-tribal U.S. citizens. You know, tribal citizens are U.S. citizens. And in every aspect of funding that the federal government interacts with the tribes are shortchanged. And, you know, we're living in the most well-to-do nation that's ever existed on the history of the earth. And it's really just a matter of federal priorities. It would take a long-term commitment to, I call it digging out of that hole. You know, if you underfund certain priorities for many decades on end, it's hard to just snap your fingers and reset that underfunding gap. But if the federal government decides to commit to bringing tribes up to where, in terms of education, healthcare, policing, every aspect of civil society, you know, the feds could do it.
Eric Henson is a research affiliate with the Harvard Project on American Indian Economic Development and also a citizen of the Chickasaw Nation. Eric, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you. Always a pleasure.
As vaccine rollouts continue across the country and some Americans begin to feel a collective sense of relief, confusion around how to manage this phase of the pandemic, including the pause of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, remains. Some of that confusion is partly because of the mixed messages health and government officials have doled out since the pandemic began, from whether to wear masks to whether schools are safe and more. But the media also share a role in making public health information clear. Here to talk about how well we're doing about the coronavirus is James Hamblin, a doctor and staff writer at The Atlantic. James, welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So you recently tweeted, and I'm quoting, "Pausing vaccination to look into a possible one in a million side effect may scare people. It could also just as easily be seen as reassuring proof that close attention is being paid to and extremely high priority put on vaccine safety." Why'd you tweet that?
I think in the early moments after that decision was announced, the way that this is being interpreted, this pause of vaccination is interpreted, is really important. And I totally understand that the reaction among many people might be to be afraid or to think that the Johnson & Johnson vaccine is bad. And overall, this is actually evidence of the system working as it's supposed to. We're supposed to be monitoring for any side effects really closely. And then in traditional circumstances, what you do is you pause and evaluate and see, you know, there's a slight elevation in the number of cases here. Is it definitely related? And how do we predict, you know, this outcome? Is there anything we can do to stop it, to say maybe if you're in a certain age group and you've had low platelet counts, you should avoid this particular vaccine? And so, you know, that should, we should expect similar issues to come up in the future and hope that we can continue to get safer and safer with the administration of vaccines.
James, it's interesting. We had a conversation early on in the show with a doctor, emergency room physician, who said one of the issues is not having doctors or medical experts in newsrooms. You happen to be both a doctor and a journalist. And so from your perspective, how has the media done in terms of handling the coronavirus messaging? Because one of the things that Dr. Rani pointed out earlier in the conversation was that, as you know, we need to get a story, right? The media needs to get a story. So have we been making that balance between getting the story and not terrifying people?
I think for the most part, journalists have been key to this pandemic, especially under the Trump administration, where we did not have reliable messaging about basic things. We had the president of the United States saying that the virus was going to go away. And it was crucial that journalists got the message out there that this was not a two-week problem. This is something that's going to last. And now it's a more interesting situation where there's less political, there's less politicization of things, and there's a weird sense of limbo where we've just sort of gotten accustomed to roughly 1,000 Americans dying every day. And the nature of the news being what it is, it becomes a top story when there's been one death that may have been related to a vaccine. And that's not to say it's not important, but I think in this moment, we might be able to do a better job of keeping things in context and helping to not panic people. I understand it's very difficult because it's important that people who've been vaccinated and are experiencing any of the symptoms that are described in these cases with the Johnson & Johnson clots, you know, seek medical attention. And so it's necessary to cover, but still the odds of having a seriously bad outcome are so much far higher from having COVID-19 than having a vaccine that I do want to keep that in perspective.
I also want to talk about the messaging around vaccines and the narratives that have emerged. Now, I want to be clear when I say this, that it is, we know that Black and Brown communities in the United States have reason to distrust the medical establishment. That is historical. That is part of our country's narrative history. However, I wonder, and I'm going to sort of, you know, just ask you straight out, I feel like the narrative of hesitancy is overplayed among communities of color and often underplayed among when it's a political question, i.e., we saw some reporting about 40% of Republicans saying they did not plan to get the vaccine. What are the dangers of that, of those narratives?
Right. Yeah, you don't want to associate people of any particular racial ethnic group of being, you know, there are connotations of people being against science or unwilling to help out the rest of the community by getting vaccinated. And so that's a dangerous line to walk while also acknowledging there are many different forms that vaccine hesitancy takes. And when it is sort of a rabid politicization and people are just in one camp and they are not going to change their mind, that's a different problem than someone who has a what's called justified distrust through decades of disenfranchisement, generations of people, you know, being poorly treated by the medical and scientific establishments. And you just need to think differently about what's the hesitation there. And I think it can be informative to think about these different types of hesitancy and certainly not to lump them all together.
Also, I want to talk a little bit about the messaging we're getting from the federal government here under the Trump administration. Even wearing a mask was something that the president really pushed back on doing, even when he himself contracted the coronavirus. And yet President Biden has essentially refused to not wear a mask. Almost every meeting we see him in, he is wearing a mask. He has set targets for vaccine distribution. How effective would you say is Biden's communication, whether it's direct or indirect, to the American public?
I think he's being much more effective, certainly very consistent in terms of mask wearing. And he shouldn't even need to wear one in many situations, since he's vaccinated and is surrounded by people who are vaccinated. And the current guidance is that when you're in those situations, you should be fine. He's doing it just to, you know, to normalize the appearance and to show that you can be a person out in the world being cautious and live your life. And that's crucial. You have, these are basic measures that should be very easy to unify around. There should not be polarization. And I hope that going forward, we see less of that, because everyone just wants this to be done. I mean, so we're so close to what could be considered a finish line. If we can just get people vaccinated, there's a lot at stake in these next few weeks and months, and we should not be divided around these simple measures as to what has to be done.
Now that this, you know, we sort of talked about how the vaccine in some areas has been politicized, right? And the narrative around vaccine hesitation has morphed depending on who we're talking about. But ultimately, I'm wondering, now that this news about the J&J vaccine has come out, how right-wing media is processing this news, how they're disseminating it to their audiences.
Well, from what I've seen, and including a statement from Donald Trump, there is an attempt to polarize people around it, to say that the Biden administration is overreacting, a sort of antagonism to whatever happens. But in effect, has the statement from Trump was the most pro-vaccine thing I've heard from him since the vaccines have been around. Honestly, he's saying we need to get these out there. People need to get vaccinated. So in a weird way, for whatever reason, it was a much needed encouragement from him. You know, this is the president who got vaccinated without telling people, without having press photos, which would have been key, and clearly has a lot of people's ear among this vaccine hesitant group of white Republicans, and could do a lot to turn the tide by being out there, you know, campaigning pro vaccination generally. And now it takes a pause in vaccination for he and his followers to become extremely pro-vaccine. So it just shows that there is polarization here that's political in nature, unfortunately, even around something that has every reason to have strong bipartisan support.
And isn't there, I saw a report that Sean Spicer, who's with Newsmax, I believe now, has, you know, tweeted about or posted on social media about him getting the vaccine. And I'm just wondering, you know, how that is. I mean, there's only so far you can run from science, or am I wrong?
Well, vaccines are interesting because they pose this freeloader dilemma where there's always, you can be at herd immunity if you're at around 80% of the community. So you could have some people who are in a vaccinated community where everyone around them is doing their part, and yet they freeload, don't get vaccinated and never get sick, and then are convinced that they didn't need to get vaccinated in the first place. So it's possible that some people will forego vaccination and be okay. But that would not be the expectation. And at the rates we're looking at right now, we are not close to herd immunity where people can depend on their community's immunity to protect them.
I was just going to say, we need a certain amount of the overall population either to be vaccinated or to have the antibodies or both, right, in order for us to get to that point. And so it would seem like this is a public health emergency that needs to be talked about and advertised, and you know, Americans need to be encouraged to do this. And if we're not all doing that, that could create pockets of lacking of vaccines. I mean, we were talking a little bit earlier about the state of Mississippi, for example, where there are thousands of vaccine appointments open and people just aren't keeping pace with the first shot, for example, compared to the national average. And so when you see things like that, that might be a direct result of media or politics, does that give you concern?
It does. I mean, I think these are solvable problems, but they often require direct conversations with people that are trusted. So physicians or family members, local leaders in the community, that won't really come from national media or national political figures, very likely, because people bring their own sets of concerns to this issue and as to why they might not want to get vaccinated. But in reality, you know, whether you're on the side of a sort of political spectrum where you value individual protection, or you're on a side where you value collective good, in either case, there's a pro-vaccine argument. This vaccine will protect you. It will make you not get sick and able to get back to normal life. And even if you don't care about yourself very much, and you wouldn't mind getting COVID-19 for whatever reason, I can't recommend that, but you need to do it in order to protect everyone around you, especially kids. You know, there have been tens of thousands of kids hospitalized with this virus. They cannot get vaccinated. And so they remain at risk as long as we allow this virus to circulate in our community. So there's every reason to to get vaccinated. And I'm confident that people who are hesitant right now can be reached, but I think it requires family and friends, people out there who know people who are, you know, unsure or just have concerns, to have long conversations, do a lot of listening, a lot of asking questions, and get them across the line to get vaccinated.
James Hamblin is a doctor and staff writer at The Atlantic. James, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
All right, everybody. It's so great to be back here with you. I've been out for a few weeks dealing with a family health emergency, but I missed the show very much, and I'm very thankful to my team and to the guest hosts who stepped in for me here at The Takeaway for holding things down. I couldn't do this without any of you. I want to hear from you out there about any of the topics we're talking about this week on the show, so record a voice memo and email it to takeawaycallers@gmail.com, or just click on Contact Us at thetakeaway.org and record a message there. Thanks so much for spending part of your day with me. I'm Tanzina Vega. This is The Takeaway, and I'll see you tomorrow.